All right, let's turn to Daniel chapter 4. Okay, chapter 4 contains the dream of the great tree. On capital A, we have the introduction, which is put together by Nebuchadnezzar, the proclamation of the king in chapter 4, verses 1 through 3. And the recipients are all the members of his kingdom, peoples, nations, languages. And that gives the simple greeting. And the reason for his proclamation is found in verse 2. It seemed good to me to show the signs and wonders the Most High God has wrought towards me. And in verse 3, we have a statement of his praise. How great are his signs, how mighty are his wonders, his kingdom, an everlasting kingdom, his dominion from generation to generation. Now, there's a lot of biblical terminology here in this verse, but also we'll see it again down in verse 37, which implies that Daniel actually drafted the statement using his own Jewish backgrounds. And the attitude of what happened in chapter 3, the attitude that brought up the circumstances of chapter 3, pride, would not be judged in chapter 4. Now keep your finger here and turn momentarily to the book of Job, chapter 33, for some background to what's happening here. Job 33. Job 33, we'll begin at verse 14. Job 33, verse 14. For God speaks once, yet twice, though man regards it not, in a dream, in a vision of the night, when deep sleep falls upon men, his slumberings upon the bed. Then he opens the ears of men and seals their instruction, that he may withdraw man from his purpose and hide pride from man. He keeps back his soul from the pit and his life from the perishing by the sword. The point of Job, notice, which is the background of what happens in Daniel chapter 4. In verse 14, God speaks once, and then he speaks twice, and man does not listen. And now God will speak to Nebuchadnezzar for the third time. In verse 15, by dream and by vision, and Nebuchadnezzar had received information by dream. In verse 16, he teaches specifically against pride in verse 17 to preserve his soul in verse 18. So God spoke to Nebuchadnezzar in chapter 2, again in chapter 3, and now he'll do it one more time in chapter 4. So back to Daniel chapter 4. So capital B in your outline, chapter 4, verses 4 through 9. Again, the failure of the wise men. Verse 4 and 5 provides the circumstance. In verse 4, this came at a time when all of his conquests has now been complete. He was at rest in his house, he was flourishing in his heart, in his palace. And in verse 5, he gets another fearful dream. And it made him afraid while he was still lying in bed. It troubled him. the visions of his head. The Aramaic word actually means extreme terror, extreme fright. So verses 6 and 7, come the wise men, the callers in verse 6, and by the official decree, which shows the seriousness by which he took the dream, and the purpose to make known the interpretation. This time he won't ask for them to tell him the dream itself. He'll tell them the dream, but he now wants the interpretation of the dream. But there was again failure, because in verse 7 the dream was related, and normally the wise men would get together and come up with the interpretation, but this time they're not able to do so. Did not make the interpretation known. Now, on one hand, it may indicate that they could not do it, unable to do it, but also another possible way to see the wording, it may indicate they would not give the interpretation because of the very negative aspect of the dream. Either way, they would not come up with the interpretation. So in verses 8 and 9, Daniel himself comes in. He came in last, and he points out in his decree, because basically chapter 4 is being written by Nebuchadnezzar, whose name was Belteshazzar. And among Babylonians, he'd be better known by his Babylonian name. And according to the name of my God, notice he still gives some credit to Bel, his God. He says, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods? Again, he has not come to the point that Isaiah 43 required to affirm that God of Israel was the only God. When it says, in whom is the spirit of the holy gods, that still falls short of monotheistic faith. And in verse 9, he addresses Daniel. But again, notice he calls him by his Aramaic name, his Babylonian name, O Belteshazzar, master of the magicians. This has been his position since chapter 2, verse 48. I know the spirit of the holy gods is in you. And he views Daniel as a master astrologer, again falling short of true saving faith. No secret troubles you. But again, Daniel does not receive his information from the stars, nor does he receive the information from the many gods and goddesses of Babylon, only from the one God of Israel. The request is, what is the meaning of the vision I have seen? So it's also a vision that he saw, not merely a dream. And what is the interpretation? So he'll give Daniel the dream in verses 10 through 18 under capital C, and the point one, the great tree, in verses 10 through 12. And what he sees in verse 10, in the midst of the earth, a tree, and the height of it was tremendously high. And verse 11 describes the development of the tree. The tree grew, was already high, but it became even higher. The tree became strong, and the height of the tree reached to heaven, not the heaven of God, but the heaven of up towards the heavens. And the sight of the tree was visible from different parts of the earth. And in verse 12, he points out the influence of the tree. The leaves were fair or beautiful. There was much fruit. There was sufficient to feed all. And the beasts of the earth rested in its shadow, and the birds of the heavens dwelt in the branches. All flesh was fed from it. But then in verses 13 through 16, under point 2, he heard the decree against the tree. And in verse 13, the one responsible for the decree was an angelic being from heaven, a watcher, a holy one. These are terms used of angels in Scripture. But it's not two angels, one holy one, one watcher. This is the use of the singular shows an angel with both titles. And this angel gave a command in verse 14 to destroy the tree. Hew it down, cut off its branches, shake off its leaves, scatter its fruit. Let the beasts get away from it. Let the fowls or birds fly away from it. But in verse 15, there is the command for a preservation. the stump with its roots to be left in the tender grass of the field, and then to be bound with a band of iron and brass, which would then protect the stump. In the statement of judgment in the second part of verse 15, first part of verse 16, let it be wet with the dew of heaven, let his portion be with the beasts in the grass of the earth, let his heart be changed from a man's heart, let a beast's heart be given unto him. And for how long will this continue? In the verse 16, till seven times pass over him. And the word times in the book of Daniel always refers to years, like 70 times and a half a time. So seven times will be 7 years. And what's the purpose of this decree and this judgment? The purpose is in verse 17. The source of the decree in verse 17 is the angelic assembly, the decree of the watchers, the mandate of the holy ones. And the intent in verse 17 is that the living may know that the Most High rules in the kingdom of men. When God's referred to as the Most High in Scripture, emphasizes God as the possessor of the heavens and the earth. As the possessor of the heavens and the earth, he can subdivide the earth as he wills and give portions of the earth to whomever he desires. And he's done so with Nebuchadnezzar, and he will do so with the subsequent empires. And God will decree how much they have and how far they will go. So he gives it to whomsoever he wills, and at this point of history he willed to give it to Babylon, and more specifically to Nebuchadnezzar. He sets up over it even the lowest of men. So he's the one that sets up kings, brings down kings, even as the lowest of men to sit on thrones. He'll bring that up again in a later chapter. This is God's sovereignty. He may use different means of attaining it. He may use descendancy, as it was called, which was with dynasties, or he may use revolts. He may even use democratic elections. But ultimately, the one that is voted in or forces himself in has been the one God has put in. That may be either for blessing or for curse. In verse 18, he gives a plea for the interpretation. In verse point 4, this dream I did see. Declare the interpretation, because the wise men were not able to make known the interpretation, but you are able. He knows Daniel well enough that Daniel can do this. And again, the reason is the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Again, falling short of faith, of saving faith. So on the capital D, Daniel now gives the interpretation of verses 19 to 27. But Daniel knows the end product, so verse 19 describes his reluctance. And the effect on Daniel is he was stricken dumb, thoughts troubled him, duration for a period of a time. And in verse 19, Nebuchadnezzar knows that Daniel realizes the consequences of the dream, of the vision. But he wants to know what's going to be. So he encourages Daniel to be upright, to be straightforward and present the interpretation. And Daniel's response comes at the end of verse 19, the dream be to them that hate you, the interpretation for the adversary. The dream and the interpretation is for the benefit of the enemies of the king and not for the king himself. So then he begins giving his interpretation, and under point 2, in verses 20 to 26, you have the interpretation with verse 20 to 22 giving us the meaning of the tree. And in verse 20 and 21, He interprets the dream and he points out in verse 22, the tree represents Nebuchadnezzar. The king has grown and become strong. The king's greatness has grown and reached unto heaven. Your dominion to the end of the earth. Again, a divine grant given to Nebuchadnezzar, which he chose not to take. And so the tree in this image, in this vision, represents Nebuchadnezzar himself. And in verses 23 or 26, the meaning of the decree. And the verse repeats in verse 23, the decree came of the watcher and the Holy One. But in verse 24, the decree is also from God Most High, that will be fulfilled within the lifetime of Nebuchadnezzar. And in verse 25, what will be the judgment? You shall be driven from among men. Your dwelling shall be with the beasts of the field. You shall be made to eat straw like an ox. You shall be wet with the dew of heaven. And for what period of time? Till 7 years pass over you, till you learn the Most High, who is the possessor of the heavens and the earth, rules in the kingdom of men. He gives it to whomsoever he wills. So Nebuchadnezzar, in his mind, he's conquered all this territory, building up the empire. But as you already heard from Jeremiah previously, and more than once from Daniel, God gave him that authority. Not any of his gods that he worships, but the God of Israel turned his own country, his own city, his own temple over to him. In verse 26, he describes the preservation. The stump remained bound with a band of iron and brass. The kingdom of Nebuchadnezzar will be preserved to be ruled by him again. And he'll come back to the throne once he knows it is the heavens that rule. Now Daniel gives some advice, a solution in verse 27, gives him some advice as how he could avoid the fulfillment of the vision. Number one, break off your sins by righteousness. This would be justification by faith. And the context of Isaiah 43, verses 10 through 12, that means he must affirm not that Jehovah is the greatest of the gods. He must affirm that Jehovah is the only God. That rules out idolatry. And therefore you have to destroy all of his idol temples, and Babylon had many. And then secondly, your iniquities by showing mercy to the poor. And this deals with the works that will follow salvation. Rather than seeking to conquer anymore, let him begin to show mercy to the poor. And the reason he should do these things, that there may be a lengthening of tranquility, the decree may be delayed and even canceled. Now go to page 4 of your outlines. And we come to the fulfillment. That's in verses 28 to 36. And the sin itself is described in verses 28 to 30. And verse 28 declares the dream was ultimately fulfilled, and verse 29 provides the occasion. It happened 12 months later, so it was a year after he had this vision. He was walking by the royal palace of Babylon. And in verse 30, he began to be filled with pride. And the content of the pride in verse 30 is this not great Babylon which I have built for the royal dwelling place? By the might of my power, by the glory of my majesty. It's similar to an archaeological discovery of a cylinder from Nebuchadnezzar. And the cylinder says, quote, "Then built I the palace, the seat of my royalty, the bond of peace of men, the dwelling of joy and rejoicing." That's his own writing in a cylinder that was discovered archaeologically. Another inscription by Nebuchadnezzar reads, and I quote, "In Babylon, my dear city, which I love, was the palace, the house of wonder of the people, the bond of the land, the brilliant palace, the abode of majesty in Babylon." He's quite proud of what he accomplished. Let me give you some measurements discovered from archaeology about Babylon, the great city. The city was built as a square, 15 miles on each side. It was surrounded by two walls, inner wall and outer wall. And the outer wall was 350 feet high, 87 feet broad at the base, and thinning some at the top. But the top was wide enough for four chariots to ride abreast. It was a very thick wall. It was surrounded by a deep moat that was filled with water by building a canal that would divert the Euphrates River to move into the surrounding moat around the wall. And the city had 12 different gates that opened up throughout the wide streets. The most famous gate, which is now in a museum in Berlin, was called the Ishtar, I-S-H-T-A-R gate, Ishtar gate. Within the walled city, which is a sizable city, there were 50 different temples to different gods and goddesses. And the Euphrates River ran through the city because Babylon was built on both sides of the Euphrates. But again, they diverted part of the river into a canal, so they also, there was the canal around the wall. And for a population, of roughly was 1,200,000 people lived in Babylon, which for ancient times, this was a very large city. He built the hanging gardens for Semiramis, meaning his wife came from Media, and Media was very woodsy. Babylonia is not very woodsy. So he built this garden of Semiramis to look like Media, where she came from. But Einstein would be towards the latter part of his reign. He reigned for a total of 43 years, but for seven of those years, he was suffering something about to be described. So rule, it began sometime after his 30th year of rule and completed well before the end of his 43rd year of rule. Now verses 31 through 33, we have the actual judgment. And in verse 31 and 32, we have a declaration from a voice but from heaven. And it came while the king was still speaking about how wonderful place he has built. So in verse 31, while he was speaking and vocalizing his pride, comes the decree, "To you it is spoken, the kingdom is departed from you." And in verse 32 came the pronouncement of the sentence, which was already prophesied previously. And verse 33 shows the fulfillment. The timing, the same hour of the statement of pride, the insanity struck. He was driven from among men. He was put away from society. He began to eat grass like an ox. There's actually a Latin name for this sickness, by the way. Insania zoanthropica. Insania, I-N, S-A-N-I-A, I-N, S-A-N-I-A. Zoanthropica, Z-O-A-N-T-H-R-O-P-I-C-A. I repeat, Z-O-A-N. T-H-R-O-P-I-C-A, when somebody believes he's an animal. There's another term used for what we specifically had was boanthropy, B-O-A-N-T-H-R-O-P-Y, B-O-A-N-T-H-R-O-P-Y, THROPI, meaning someone who thinks he's an ox. That's what he thinks he is. So his body was wet with the dew of heaven. His grass, his hair grew like eagle's feathers, emphasizing the thickness of his hair. His nails like bird's claws. And he lived that way off the throne for 7 years. There's some archaeological verification of what this chapter describes, because a Greek historian named Berossus, B-E-R-O-S-S-U-S, B-E-R-O-S-S-U-S, after reigning for 3 years, Nebuchadnezzar took ill and died. It was common for somebody to be ill before dying. And so normally the sickness before death was not mentioned in ancient records, but the fact is mentioned in the case of Nebuchadnezzar may be a reference to the judgment he experienced, because this is abnormal. A king would die, but doesn't say that he was sick before that, but with Nebuchadnezzar it is. Some other quotes which should be too lengthy to read. But I'll just summarize this one quote from an archaeological record concerning Nebuchadnezzar. Now it says the following: suddenly became possessed by some god or other, and this is the ancient term for insanity. Secondly, happened while he was on the palace roof, which is what Daniel describes when he was hit. A Thursday, he suddenly disappears, driven from men to be among animals. And both occurred towards the latter part of his reign. Another inscription found in archaeology, when Nebuchadnezzar inscribed, it says, "For 4 years the seat of my government in my city did not rejoice my heart. In all my dominions I did not build a high place of power. The precious treasures of my kingdom I did not lay out in the worship of Merodach, my lord, the joy of my heart in Babylon, the city of my sovereignty. I did not sing his praises, I did not furnish his altars, nor did I clear out the canals." And this quotation shows he was in a depressed state. For a period of time, he did not perform any of his royal duties, kingly duties. There's some other quotations I won't take bother reading, but the fact that something unique happened to Nebuchadnezzar that affected his mind is clearly verified by archaeological records outside the Bible. But point three, the restoration, as was also predicted, eventually came. In the verses 34 and 35, there's the confession: at the end of days, after 7 years, I lifted up my eyes unto heaven, and my understanding returned to me. So after 7 years of looking on the ground, this is the turning point. And the ability to recognize God is the fundamental difference between man and animals. Elisha's the praise: I blessed the Most High, I praised him, I honored him. He spells out the nature of the Most High God. He lives forever. His everlasting dominion, his kingdom is from generation to generation. All that happens are pure as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heaven. He does according to his will among the inhabitants of the earth. None can stay his hand. None can object. And again, the biblical terminology shows that Nebuchadnezzar has told his experiences to Daniel, and Daniel puts it into more biblical terminology. So verse 36, "At the same time understanding returned unto me, when he acknowledged the Most High God as Lord." Then came the fulfillment of the band of iron, the band of brass. The glory of the kingdom returned, the majesty and brightness returned, counselors and lords sought after him. He didn't have to fight to take back his throne. Nobody was sitting on the throne while he was gone. "I was established in my kingdom." excellent greatness was added unto me, greater than what he had before he was struck with insanity. So in verse 37, you have the conclusion. The praise of the King of Heaven, extol, honor, reason, all his works are truth, his ways are just. And the lesson within the text is those who walk in pride, he's able to abase. Those that walk in pride, he's able to abase. But the lesson should be applied from the wider context. The pride of the Gentile world powers will be destroyed. That's the key lesson here. The pride of Gentile world powers will be destroyed. Okay, let's now go to chapter 5, Roman numeral 5, the Feast of Belshazzar. Now, capital A, the feast in chapter 5, verses 1 through 4, is being described. And the making of the feast is in verse 1. Now, if you don't mind, go back to the back of your outline. And look at the capital. Let me give you a rundown of the Babylonian kings. The first king was Nebuchadnezzar, who ruled from 605 to, this is page 11 of your outlines, by the way. Turn to page 11. After Nebuchadnezzar, the new king was known as Amel-Marduk or Evil-Marduk, who ruled from 562 to 560. He's mentioned elsewhere in 2 Kings 25, verses 27 to 30, 2 Kings 25, verses 27 to 30, and also Jeremiah chapter 52, verses 31 to 34. Jeremiah 52, 31 to 34. He was the son of Nebuchadnezzar, but then he was killed by number three, Nergal-Sarbetter. And he ruled from 560 to 556. 560 to 560. To 556. He's mentioned in Jeremiah chapter 39, verse 3 and 13. Jeremiah 39, verse 3 and 13. He was the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar, and he was the brother-in-law of number two, Evil-Merodach. He was followed by Labashi-Marduk. Labashi-Marduk, who ruled for 2 months in the months of May and June in 556, May-June 556. He was the son of number three, the son of Nergal-Sar. He was also the grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. But he was assassinated by number five, Nabonidus. Nabonidus ruled from 556 to 539, 556 to 539. Nabonidus was the son-in-law of Nebuchadnezzar. He was married to the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar, Nitocris, N-I-T-O-C-R-I-S. N-I-T-O-C-R-I-S, and he was the father of number six, Belshazzar. However, Nebuchadnezzar did not like to live in Babylon, so he lived in there for 3 years, then chose to leave and live elsewhere. So he appointed Belshazzar or Belshazzar to be a co-regent, and so there were co-regents from 553 to 539. Since he was co-regent, he was the second top man in the government. I'll explain something about we're about to see in chapter 5. So Nebuchadnezzar was still the first top man of the empire, and his son Belshazzar was the second top man. Now, when Jeremiah prophesied about the rule of Nebuchadnezzar, in Jeremiah chapter 27, verse 6 and 7, Jeremiah 27, verse 6 and 7, Jeremiah prophesied the lineage of Nebuchadnezzar was to end with his grandson. The lineage of Nebuchadnezzar and his grandson, and that would be Belshazzar. Now, for some historical background, let's go back to outline chapter 5. As I mentioned, Nebuchadnezzar did not care to live in Babylon, so he moved to a city called Tama. This was in the Arabian area. He preferred to live there. In fact, he once lived in Tama for 14 years without coming to visit Babylon. But he gave Belshazzar full power in Babylon beginning the year 553 BC. And Belshazzar means Bel, protect the king. Bel, protect the king. Now, some background to the feast happening in chapter 5. It takes place in the year 539 BC, the year of the fall of Babylon. And so the time between chapter 4 and chapter 5 is 23 years. That's the gap of time between chapter 4 and chapter 5, 23 years. Again, he doesn't write in chronological sequence, so the events of chapter 7 took place 14 years before this feast, in the year 553. And chapter 8 took place 11 years before this feast, in the year 551. But now by the year 539, various provinces of the empire had already broken away and declared independence. Nebuchadnezzar had gone out to fight against the Medes and the Persians, but his army lost and he was captured. The surrounding territory around Babylon has been captured by the Medes and the Persians. So now essentially Babylon, the city alone, is standing. It was now being surrounded and besieged by the Medes and the Persians. It's in this context that Belshazzar makes a great feast for thousands of his lords. The Eastern monarchs are known to give a feast for as many as 15,000 people. Now, why is he doing so? Probably to give the lords some confidence, because the Medes and the Persians were besieging outside the wall. And so this feast is to give them, put more faith in the gods of the Babylons, of Babylon, to save the city from the invasion and the besiegers, to build faith in the Babylonian gods. Also to build faith in Babylon's fortifications, which I described earlier. And one thing I didn't mention is that the watchtowers, there were 250 watchtowers 100 feet higher than the top of the wall. And those 12 gates were made of solid brass. And the moats around the city was 30 feet around. And so in verse 1 again, Belshazzar calls for this festival. Now for many, many years, I might point out, critics made fun of the book of Daniel because there was no record of any Belshazzar. But then archaeological records began showing there was a Belshazzar that was king of Babylon at the same contemporary time as King Nabonidus. And all the cuneiform records they found and archaeologically referred to Belshazzar as the son of the king. So people don't criticize Daniel anymore on that score. They criticize him for something else, because in the archaeological records, he's only called the son of the king, but Daniel calls him the king. I would say that's a rather minor point. And as verse 1 concludes, it says, Belshazzar drank wine before the thousand, and this was an act of worship of the gods of Babylonia. And it's about to set the stage for what would happen next. Because what he does in verses 2 through 4, he's not happy with praising the gods of Babylon to rescue Babylon. So he does in verse 2 that he commanded that the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar brought from Jerusalem and put into the temple of his God was not to be brought in. And what he's going to do now, he will drink the wine in the worship of the gods of Babylon from the very vessels that have been dedicated for the work of Jehovah. It says he's made this command while he tasted the wine. He drank too much and began to lose his good judgment. And so the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar brought from the temple in Jerusalem, he orders to be brought into the chamber of the feast, so that they too could drink from it. That included the king, his lords, his wives, his concubines. And the desecration comes in verse 3. They partook of the holy vessels, praising the gods of Babylon. And in verse 4, the lords took the same pattern, praising the gods of Babylon. And that's when suddenly they see a strange sight of a hand writing on the wall on the capital B. Verses 5 and 6. The writing is in verse 5 and says, in the same hour that the desecration was taking place, the same hour when they were drinking of these vessels, a hand comes out of the wall, and there's also a finger of the hand of a man. And the finger writes certain words right against the lampstand, that would be the brightest part of the banquet hall. So it became visible very quickly. Began to run the plaster of the wall of the king's palace. Now this banquet hall has been uncovered in archaeology. It was about 56 feet wide, 173 feet long. The walls were made of white plaster. And the king saw part of the hand that wrote. He saw the palm outward. And in verse 6, we're told the effect it had on the king. His countenance was changed in him. He lost his brightness. He turned pale, although he had been flushed with wine. Now it's pale. His thoughts troubled him. His joints began to shake. His very hips shook. And then these began to smite one against the other. As Nebuchadnezzar had done before, so does Belshazzar. He calls in the wise men in verses 7 through 9. And the command is for all the wise men to be brought in to read the writing and to show the interpretation. And he promises them a reward. Three things. Number one, they'll be clothed with purple. This is a symbol of high rank. Secondly, a gold chain about his neck. This is a gift of kings. And also the next third thing, shall be the third ruler of the kingdom. That's the highest position Belshazzar could offer. Because he was the co-regent, his father Nebuchadnezzar was first, that made Belshazzar the second, and whoever interprets the handwriting on the wall, that will put him third. This shows how accurate the book of Daniel is historically. But in verse 8, we cross the failure. Number one, they could not read it. Number two, they could not interpret it. It's dealt on the king in verse 9. The king was troubled, countenance changed even further. And all the lords in the banquet hall were perplexed. So capital D, we have the advice of the queen in verses 10 through 12. In verse 10, the entrance of the queen, this is again Nitocris. She's not the wife of Belshazzar. Those wives already had the feast in verse 3. But she's the queen mother. She was the wife of Nabonidus, and she was the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. So she has a long history with Daniel. And she comes into the banquet house because of the words she hears from the king and from the lords. Her advice in verse 10 to 12 is number 1 in verse 10, don't be afraid or be troubled. And then she gives her evaluation of Daniel in verse 11, the first part of verse 12. And she says, number one, he is the spirit of the holy gods. Again, this is still in pagan terminology. He has light, understanding, and wisdom. He proved himself in the days of Nebuchadnezzar with light, understanding, and wisdom. Like the wisdom of the gods, again, notice, short of saving faith. They recognize something supernatural about Daniel, but they still are not willing to give glory to the one true God. And she reminds Belshazzar in verse 11 that he was appointed to be the head of the wise men in charge of all the magicians, enchanters, Chaldeans, and soothsayers. Now what she says indicates he was no longer in that position, which helps to explain why Belshazzar but Belshazzar would not know him. There is upheavals that happened between the death of Nebuchadnezzar and the enthronement of Nabonidus. As a result, Daniel was removed from his leadership position. And so Belshazzar does not know anything about much about Daniel. He's heard some things, but that's it. And then she spells out Daniel's abilities, and she's quite detailed. Number one, he's got an excellent spirit. Secondly, he has knowledge. Third, he has understanding. Fourth, he knows how to interpret dreams. Fifth, he knows how to interpret or show dark sentences. Sixth, he's a dissolver of doubts. Seven, untying knots, and eight, solver of riddles. And she says you should bring Daniel in, who'll be able to show you the interpretation of what's on the wall. So capital E, we have the appeal to Daniel, verses 13 through 16. In verse 13, we have the identification of Daniel. Daniel is brought in, and Belshazzar asks him, are you the same Daniel, who's of the captivity of the children of Judah? Are you the Daniel who is a Jew? The one that my father brought out of Judah? So this statement shows he's no longer the head of the wise men. And Belshazzar knows something about Daniel because of what he heard, but nothing much about Daniel. And so he says what he knows from his reputation, that he just learned from his mother. And in verse 14, I have heard of you. The spirit of the gods is in you. And the qualities found in you are light, understanding, excellent wisdom. And that's, of course, just came from his mother. And in verse 15, he points out the failure of the wise men. They were brought in to read the writing to show the interpretation, but they failed. And so now he makes his appeal in verse 16. I have heard of you that you can give interpretations, that you can dissolve doubts. If you're able to read the writing to give the interpretation, I will give you those three rewards. Clothed with purple, a chain of gold, and you become the third top man in the government. So in the capital letter, we have the response of Daniel in verses 17 through 28. And in verses 17 to 24, you have the condemnation of Belshazzar. In verse 17, Daniel declares, he rejects the gifts, he rejects the rewards. He will read, he'll interpret, but he has no reason to want those rewards. After all, they only last for one day. Because Babylon, Medo-Persia, will capture the city the very next day. In fact, actually that night. So instead he begins giving Belshazzar a lesson of history in verses 18 to 21. And in verses 18 and 19, the rising of Nebuchadnezzar, he was divinely appointed by the Most High God, and it was God of Israel, the God of Jerusalem, that gave him the kingdom, the greatness, the glory, and the majesty. In verse 19, the results of divine appointment, all trembled and feared him, peoples, nations, languages. He carried out his will. Whom he would, he slew. Whom he would, he kept alive. Whom he would, he raised up. Whom he would, he put down. He was an absolute monarch, but nevertheless, he fell also under the judgment of God. So verse 20 and 21 reminds Belshazzar of the debasement of Nebuchadnezzar. The cause of the judgment in verse 20 was his pride. His heart was lifted up, and spirit was hardened. And so that meant he was deposed, not replaced, only deposed from his kingly throne, and that took the glory from him. And verse 21 describes his insanity. He was driven from among the sons of men. His heart was made like the animals. His dwelling was with the wild donkeys, meaning he was wandered about. He was fed grass like an oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven. But in verse 21, when he finally recognized the Most High rules in the kingdom of men, he sets over it whomsoever he wills. And now he focuses on the sin of Belshazzar in verses 22 to 24. And verse 22, notice Belshazzar's knowledge. You know all this. The sin of Nebuchadnezzar was a sin out of ignorance. Belshazzar's sin was not out of ignorance. Still, he failed to humble himself. In verse 23, he shows his own pride and defiance against the God of heaven. He brought the vessels of the temple to drink wine from them, not just by himself, but also by his lords, by his wives, and by his concubines. So because of what he already knew, that's the point here, because of what he already knew, he purposely desecrated the vessels to show he was not intimidated by this God of Jerusalem. And with these vessels of the one and only true God, he praised the gods made of gold, brass, iron, wood, stone. Gods that do not see, do not hear, do not know anything. And he failed to glorify the true God. At least Nebuchadnezzar, well, he did not give up his polytheism. He did elevate the God of Israel to being the chief of the gods. But Belshazzar failed to even do that much. He did not glorify the true God who controls your breath, therefore your life, who controls your ways, therefore your destiny. And then in verse 24, the judgment. Part of his hand was sent, and the writing was inscribed. And now we come to the writing and the interpretation. But my hour's up. I'll have to keep you in suspense till after your next coffee break.